I'm Afshin Ratansi, and welcome back to Going Underground, broadcasting all around the world from the UAE. Ahead of November's election, so-called mainstream corporate propaganda media in the United States will center analysis on personality and identity instead of class. It wasn't always so. Once it was the working classes and organized labor that terrified U.S. elites and threatened their control. But as neoliberal inequality has risen over decades, the worker is back. Last year saw over 500,000 workers across industries from automotive to aviation to entertainment hitting the picket lines in nearly 400 strikes in the US. Genocide Joe Biden even intervened to make transport strikes illegal. Joining me now is Labour journalist Hamilton Nolan, author of The Hammer, Power, Inequality and the Struggle for the Soul of Labour. Hamilton himself played a key role in unionising the workforce at Gawker Media. He joins me now from New York. Hamilton, thank you so much for coming on. I understand your book has made the USA Today bestseller list. What drove you to write it, and how come it struck such a chord, seemingly, in the United States in an election year?
Well, I have been a labor journalist for a long time, and I, as you mentioned, got the opportunity to help organize my own workplace at Gawker Media in 2015. I got a chance to see the labor movement both from the outside as a journalist and from the inside as somebody participating in my own union. And, you know, as a backdrop to this book, 50 years of rising inequality in the United States of America, particularly since the Reagan era, has led us to a point when people have gotten fed up. And public opinion polls tell us today that unions are as popular as they have been in 60 years in the United States of America. So I think that we may have finally hit a tipping point when people are ready to reclaim the worker power that has been lost to them over past generations.
Yeah, it was odd even at the Academy Awards to hear people talk about the successful writers' strike over there. But at the same time, what exactly happened with Joe Biden and the transport workers? he enacted a law to stop the strike.
Yeah, Joe Biden likes to tout himself as the most pro-union president of our lifetimes, which I think he probably is, although it's an extremely low bar if you think even of Democratic presidents like Bill Clinton and Barack Obama. The ones in my lifetime did not really spend a lot of their own political capital to help prop up unions or promote worker power. So by those low standards, Biden has been a very pro-union president. However, as you mentioned, when the railroad workers went to go on strike, which would have been the biggest strike of his presidency, he did use his power to prevent them from going on strike, which is unfortunately has become the standard for presidents who, under the Railway Labor Act, which is a sort of law designed to contain worker power in those transportation industries. But he could have chosen not to do that fundamentally. And the fact that he stopped that strike, I think, is the biggest mark against him and his claim to be a real pro-union president.
Doesn't the Constitution come into action there to protect workers?
Unfortunately, there's U.S. labor law is very anti-worker fundamentally, and especially in those transportation industries which have their own law called the Railway Labor Act, which restricts them even more than private sector workers. So it's very difficult for those workers to pull off large-scale strikes because the government has given itself the power to order them not to do so.
So it's like if they really threaten corporate profits, that's what comes into action. I mean, in the 50s, Hollywood, of course, had Marlon Brando in On the Waterfront, used as part of the cultural propaganda war to destroy the reputation of trade unions across the United States. What are they using right now then? Because seemingly people are saying, yeah, unions are good, but at the same time, as the railway workers' strike shows, underneath the surface, there are subtle ways the powerful can use to stop workers organizing?
Well, you know, since the 1980s in particular, and since the Ronald Reagan era, unions have really declined culturally, economically, socially, mathematically. In all ways, union density has been on the decline with the rise of deregulation from the Reagan era, and then with the rise of neoliberalism that was promoted by Democratic presidents as well as Republican presidents. I think that, however, we have reached the time when that might be changing, and particularly since the pandemic years when tens of millions of American workers found themselves out of work, found themselves in crisis, found themselves deemed essential workers without being given pay raises. All of those things have served to kind of radicalize a new generation of workers in America. And I think culturally and politically and economically, we're starting to see a potential turnaround in the way that people think about unions and labor in America. And the question is whether the labor movement itself, which has kind of been rendered weak over all these decades of decline, can take advantage of this moment.
So if people in the United States are watching this and want to form a trade union in a private sector business, tell me what obstacles they're gonna come up against to prevent them from organizing their labor.
Well, the first obstacle is that labor laws in America make it very easy for employers to retaliate against workers for trying to form unions, even though it is technically illegal for employers to retaliate for organizing activity. The penalties for doing that are almost non-existent. And so big employers know that it's actually in their interest to do things like fire workers who try to organize, to intimidate workers who try to organize. Those tactics come with such small penalties that companies are really economically incentivized to crack down on unions and pursue union busting. So that's the first obstacle that workers have to encounter. And the other obstacle really is again, the weakness of organized labor itself. All of those decades of decline have made it very hard for workers to do simple and basic things like get in contact with a union organizer, find a union that is willing to put the resources behind them to pursue a successful organizing campaign, to fight against employers that are union busting. So on both sides, workers are dealing with obstacles, both of the company being able to step on their necks and then trying to find a union that is willing to help them out and back them in their struggle.
The AFL-CIO in the book, you call them a mediocre in-house lobbying firm. It's known around the world that organization is something that has promoted death squads and torture across Latin America and in the global South. Tell me what the AFL-CIO is, first of all, because many people might recognize it as a cutout of the intelligence agencies, and how it's supposed to help trade unions and workers around the world, but actually has been performing a different role.
Right. So the AFL-CIO is the largest federation of unions in the United States of America, 60 unions. It has around, I believe, 13 million total members. So it is not a union itself, but it is a labor federation, the biggest and most powerful labor federation in America. As you mentioned, throughout the history of the AFL, it has been plagued by a lot of problems, not the least of which are some of its foreign policy positions that has taken over many years. It's also historically been a fairly conservative labor federation, has always fallen on the conservative spectrum of labor history. But the fact remains that when you look at organized labor in America, for better or worse, the AFL-CIO is the organization that sits at the center of it. Most union members in America are technically members of the AFL-CIO. And so when you think of a starting point to build a stronger labor movement in America, it is going to start inside the AFL-CIO, like it or not, because that is the organization that exists. That is the table that most of the biggest unions in America are sitting around. So it's an organization that has a lot of potential, domestically at least, to be the place that helps to rebuild the labor movement in America. But it has always suffered from conservatism and a little bit of a lack of ambition and a lack of a vision.
You called it mediocre and a lobbying firm. And, you know, their statement, I'm speaking to you from the Middle East, on the genocide in the Middle East was, they recommended a negotiated ceasefire. They weren't even clear enough, unlike many other trade unions, about what's happening here in the Middle East, to call for a proper ceasefire in Gaza.
Yeah, I mean, it's always going to probably be disappointing to look to the AFL-CIO for moral leadership.
But isn't it time to abolish it and start something new? Like, many unions are going their separate ways, and they have done, haven't they, when there are more conservative elements in organized labor that are preventing them fight for their rights?
Yeah, there have been instances in labor history when the more progressive unions and unions that really wanted to pursue organizing have split off from the AFL-CIO. It happened early in the 20th century when they formed the CIO, and it happened again in the late 20th century when they formed a coalition called Change to Win. Both those instances were unions that wanted to pursue big industrial organizing, and they were frustrated by the AFL-CIO's reluctance to do that. So it's always been the same thing with the AFL-CIO. However, abolishing it, the problem is if you abolish it, you just have to rebuild it again from the ground up. So I would like to see it taken over and used as a tool for good rather than abolished.
So tell me about Sarah Nelson. I know in the Reagan era, breaking the pilots union was a major part of Ronald Reagan in the 80s to forge the neoliberal world we now exist in. And I also, Denis Kucinich, people can see our interview with him, he might be going for Congress again, talked about all the nefarious ways attempts are made to destroy political power that helps workers. Why is Sarah Nelson such a hero for you in the book?
Sarah Nelson is the head of the Association of Flight Attendants, which is the union for flight attendants in the United States. She is sort of the running central figure of my book. She's a very passionate, progressive, fiery labor leader that I have always admired as a labor journalist. One of the first union leaders that I ever interviewed that I felt like really grasped the scale of the problems that labor faces in America and had the sort of drive and the ambition to try to fix those problems. She is a great progressive. She's an ally of Bernie Sanders. She is one of the most prominent left-wing labor leaders. And in the book, I sort of follow her struggle of how and whether to become a leader of the larger labor movement and some of the challenges with trying to pull together leadership in a movement that is so disparate and divided politically and otherwise.
So there have been some successful strikes recently. Of course, these don't make the big headlines. Ones at Amazon, I understand. Starbucks, which actually is being the subject of boycotts in Asia over its relationship with Israel. How did the Starbucks strikes succeed?
Starbucks has been a very inspirational organizing campaign started a couple of years ago, and they decided to unionize one store at a time, and they've successfully unionized 400 stores now across America. The Starbucks Workers Campaign has very grassroots campaign, very worker driven, a lot of young, ideologically motivated workers at these stores who've done a lot of the work themselves to spread this organizing campaign. And at the same time, the billionaire founder of Starbucks, Howard Schultz, who ironically was going to... Sorry?
I've actually interviewed him.
Oh, yeah. He ironically was going to be Hillary Clinton's choice for labor secretary, and now he's the most notorious union buster in the United States of America. But recently, they did... in fact, get Starbucks to agree to come to the table and negotiate a contract with that union. So they have a light at the end of the tunnel for that campaign, and it's been very successful. And as you mentioned, they were on the forefront of calling for a ceasefire in Gaza, something that spread to a lot of other unions as well.
Hamilton Nolan, I'll stop you there. More from the author of the new book, The Hammer: Power, Inequality, and the Struggle for the Soul of Labor, after this break. Welcome back to Going Underground. I'm still here with Hamilton Nolan, author of the new book, The Hammer, Power, Inequality, and the Struggle for the Soul of Labor. We were talking about successes as regards, say, Starbucks, but all these unions are backing Joe Biden this November. That includes, obviously, the AFL-CIO, FGA, AFSCME, AFT, NNU. People can look these up. There's all these acronyms. It was difficult enough, I think, working out UAW shop floor different numbers. I think the first thing they need to do is make their unions easier to understand, like corporate logos, perhaps. Why is it they back Joe Biden? Biden's choice of Federal Reserve boss, Jerome Powell, obviously he was there before, says it's high wage growth that's the problem in the United States. That's why inflation is there. Even Forbes magazine is saying that's a bit harsh. It's not actually the root of all evil. high wage growth? Do you think many of these union workers are seeing high wage growth and then blaming themselves because of Biden's Fed boss?
Well, you know, the United States of America is a two-party system, and this has always been a challenge that faced organized labor in America, is that there's a big incentive for the Democratic Party to take unions for granted, because the Republican Party is a party that wants to essentially abolish unions altogether and stamp out all organized labor power. And so the choice has always been the Democrats, because the other choice is so bad. At the same time, of course, Biden, who has been relatively pro-union, still has his drawbacks. You know, as a president, even as far as labor is concerned, you mentioned the railroad strike and other issues. So the question becomes always,
relatively pro-union when enacting legislation against a powerful union. Just as you said, it's a very low bar. And of course, all around the world, Biden's foreign policy has been acting arguably against unionized and organized labor in foreign policy.
Right. I mean, the question for unions is, how do you exert influence on Joe Biden? Because Trump is a non-starter. Trump is a guy who was kicked out of his own union for being a scab. I mean, he is completely anti-union. So there is no other choice for Biden. At the same time, unions cannot sit back and allow Biden and the Democratic Party to take them for granted. So they have to figure out how to apply pressure and how to influence Biden in the right direction.
So third-party candidates have never been an issue. We had Cornel West on this show. You know, there are these other candidates. Trade unions will just be looking to the powerful to bestow their privileges to workers rather than seeking out third-party candidates, even though from WikiLeaks we know how Hillary Clinton, say, destroyed Bernie Sanders' chance of ever becoming president by using the DNC against a candidate like Sanders.
I think Bernie Sanders, who was a candidate within the Democratic Party, would have been a great candidate for labor and had a lot of labor backing and was probably the most pro-labor candidate that I've seen in my lifetime, who also had a viable chance of winning the Democratic nomination. The problem, again, with third-party candidates in the United States of America is that unless they have a viable chance of winning, all you do is cut down support to the candidate closest to your side. So there's problems with the design of the American electoral system that make it very hard for third-party candidates to be viable sources of power for unions to support.
Is another problem that, given Biden's avowed choice for Keynesian militarism, growth in the U.S. economy depends on the proxy war through Ukraine, on sending billions of dollars of worth of weapons to Israel to kill in Gaza, that necessarily the big trade unions are going to be representing the weapons industry and the military industrial complex that any moral person wants to avoid and destroy in favor of peacemaking infrastructure investment.
Well, this has certainly been a perpetual problem in the United States of America, particularly since World War II. You know, a lot of America's economic growth since World War II has been fueled by the defense industries and by various wars around the world. So that is an inescapable issue, I think, that is even larger than the labor movement. It is true that there are some factions of organized labor that are more concerned with their own jobs than they are with geopolitical issues. And so it's not uncommon to find unions supporting anything that will give them jobs, even if something bad is coming of it. On the other hand, it is possible for organized labor as a whole to have more moral positions and to combine. And you see that, for example, in a big coalition of unions that has come together to call for a ceasefire in Gaza. And that includes some of the biggest and strongest unions in the AFL-CIO and out of the AFL-CIO.
Yeah, but they haven't downed tools at the big, Lockheed Martin, Raytheon, these big companies effectively receiving subsidy from the American taxpayer or the American purse. And if it is the threat of nuclear war that we're headed for because of the war in Ukraine, no sign that workers will see beyond their daily pay rates and realize they've got to down tools because of policy that is giving them their jobs, because their lives might be in danger too.
Yeah, I mean, most of the anti-militaristic sentiment within the labor movement is very much at the grassroots level of the labor movement. So you see grassroots activists inside of unions, for example, organizing today to try to shut down arms shipments to some of the ports in America and to get the longshore workers to actually refuse to serve those ships. That's an example of an action that is happening today, but again, very grassroots driven. Those things are not coming down from the top of organized labor. They're not coming from the AFL-CIO. They're not typically coming from the union presidents. They're coming from the workers themselves. And so, yes, it is true that we need to elevate that kind of sentiment up to the top of the labor movement. And there are not a lot of signs that is going to happen anytime soon.
You know, overseas, the National Endowment for Democracy is known as union busting in the way it has been accused of trying to stop organized labor in the developed world. In the United States, there's been a history of sellouts. What about covert action today in organized labor? Have you witnessed it as a labor reporter over the years? Are there suspect actors, as it were, involved in creating trouble to stop workers organizing like they used to during the McCarthy years?
You know, it's not something that I've really witnessed as a labor journalist. And I think, unfortunately, the truth is, like, they don't need covert actors to give troubles to unions these days. I mean, there are enough bad union leaders out there, and there is so much power on the corporate side right now. And the laws are so tilted in favor of corporate power that all they need to do is to simply union bust, and they can be very open about it. And they are very open about it. And they have teams of lawyers that do it, and they have teams of anti-union consultants that do it. And so undermining the labor movement is something that the government, the federal government, and particularly a lot of state governments are very openly involved in themselves. They don't need any covert actors for that in the United States, at least.
So it stands at around 10% then, membership now. And, famously, Trump's speech when he was inaugurated talking about the deindustrialization of the Midwest, clear that many of those 10% will be voting Trump and not for Joe Biden, given Joe Biden talks about the middle classes and doesn't really seem to appeal to the industrial base of the United States, which is clearly going to be required if the United States is going to prosper and grow economically.
Yeah, one of the reasons why new union organizing is so important in the United States is that our national politics have become so polarized that it's very hard to see ways for us to break out of this red versus blue two-party head-to-head cycle that we're in, downward spiral that has given us the rise of Trump now over three consecutive elections. And one of the only ways that you can bring people together, particularly in those devastated American heartland states that were economically decimated by neoliberalism and by offshoring, is to get people into unions and to show them the potential of a truly democratic organization, not democratic like electoral politics, which is not in fact democratic, but truly democratic in the sense of a well-run union. That can be the foundation to bridge that gap between red and blue, between all types of workers coming together to pursue a common goal. And I really believe that new union organizing can be the path that leads us out of this impasse. However, as you said, at only 10% of Americans having unions, we're not going to get there. There needs to be a very, very big, large-scale effort to get more Americans into unions so we can use that tool.
Clearly, AI is going to be used as an organizing tool by workers, and technology is going to be used by those trying to lobby senators and congressmen against the corporate lobbying power for multinationals. How are the bosses going to be using AI to destroy worker power?
Yeah, unfortunately, I think that the first way the bosses are going to use AI is just to eliminate jobs. I think that all of the jobs that are easily automated by AI are going to be automated by AI, particularly by bosses that don't care so much about quality and in industries that might have thought that they were safe from automation. So the last wave of automation was in the manufacturing industries, and now you're going to see AI automation come for the knowledge industries and the white collar industries, where a lot of workers had assumed that their jobs were not possible to be automated away. And when you saw the strikes last year in Hollywood among the actors and the screenwriters, a big, big concern of those strikes was how AI was going to be used in the entertainment industry. So those unions are seeing the dangers of AI coming down the pike, and they're starting to regulate those things in union contracts. And you're really going to see, I think, that union contracts will be the place that build the firewalls and the protections for workers against AI well before the government is ever able to do it.
And so, given that your book talks about the unions being of paramount importance in reducing inequality, which has been rising over decades, if unions can't be as powerful as they used to be because of all these innovations like AI, what else is it going to be to stop the inequality?
Well, the only other thing that's capable of turning around inequality is government action, federal government action in particular. And I am pretty optimistic about the prospect. I'm sorry, pessimistic. Pessimistic about the prospects of federal government action doing that, because clearly for the past 50 years, the trend lines have been moving in the opposite direction. And so that is one reason why I feel so invested in the success of unions in particular, is that the options out there are very bad outside of building labor power and worker power in the context of unions and allowing working people to claim a larger share of the nation's wealth for themselves. Other than that, you're depending on politicians, and the track record of politicians is very bad on that front.
I thought you were going to quote Kennedy, "Those who make peaceful revolution impossible make violent revolution inevitable."
Well, I'm hoping for peace in any case.
Harold and Nolan, thank you.
Thank you.
And that's it for the show. The new book, The Hammer, Power, Inequality, and the Struggle for the Soul of Labour, is out now. Remember, we're bringing you new episodes every Saturday and Monday. Until then, keep in touch via all our social media if it's not censored in your country. And head to our channel, Going Underground TV, on rumble.com to watch new and old episodes of Going Underground. See you soon.